Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 1 through 14. Welcome to our next lecture on Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 1 through 14. So last week's lecture, my first online, was on 1 Samuel chapter 16, and that first lecture was very dry. And this week's lesson is about dry bones. I wonder if there's a connection. Nope, there's not. Just my dry sense of humor. All right, just trying to add some levity to this. So, in talking about Ezekiel, I am assuming that you have read the passage we're talking about. And I am assuming that you have the Bible in front of you. Turn to the chapter. We will make references occasionally throughout the book, though. The book of Ezekiel is the third of the major prophets, right behind Isaiah and Jeremiah. Remember, the ranking major is only due to the length of the book, not the quality of the message. The same is true for the minor prophets. That designation refers only to the length of the book. So when we say major, we're not saying that it's a more important message than the minor. It just has to do with how long the books are. Ezekiel's book, the poems, are verbal icons. It uses graphic verbal images to paint vibrant pictures. From the opening vision of God on a chariot throne to the final description of a city renewed, the book of Ezekiel is visual in its orientation. The messages that the prophet relays are not just ideas, but visual metaphors. Besides clarity of structure, the book of Ezekiel reveals a symmetry. The vision of the desecrated temple fit for destruction, given to us in chapters 8 through 11, is balanced by the vision of the restored and purified temple in chapters 40 through 48. The God presented in agitated wrath in chapter 1 is also seen as a God of comfort. The Lord is there in chapter 48, verse 35. Ezekiel's call to be a watchman announcing divine judgment in chapter 3 is balanced by his call to be a watchman announcing the new age to follow in chapter 33. In one place, chapter 6, the mountains of Israel receive a prophetic rebuke, but in chapter 36, they are consoled. The book of Ezekiel contains four major visions, chapters 1 through 3, chapters 8 through 11, our passage, chapter 37, 1 through 14, that's the third one, and the fourth vision in chapters 40 through 48. In the book, there are also 12 symbolic acts, and there are five messages that are in the form of parables. Ezekiel wrote his prophetic book from 597 to 570 BC, which overlapped the ministries of Jeremiah, who was around from 627 to 585, Daniel, who was around from 605 to 530, and the minor prophets of Joel from 596 to 586, and Obadiah in 590 BC. Ezekiel records speaking to God directly at least 90 times, which is the most of any biblical writer. And Ezekiel became the first prophet to be commissioned outside of Judah or Israel before Jerusalem is destroyed in 587 BC. Now, way back, about 100 years before Ezekiel was born, the northern kingdom fell to the Assyrian Empire. That was in 722 BC. Remember, the two kingdoms had split after the reign of Solomon. The 10 tribes to the north, the two tribes to the south, they were known as Judah, and also known as the Southern Kingdom. And the Southern Kingdom had been able to keep from being totally conquered by Assyria by being a vassal That is by being subordinate, a subject of the Assyrian Empire, which means that the country Judah had the pretense of independence and self-government, but it was not real, and they paid a huge amount of money to keep the pretense going. And then the Assyrian Empire had a rapid decline, and Hosea, who was the king of Judah and who had already begun a religious renewal of the country, was able to assert his independence from Assyria around 630, and continuing his religious reforms by stressing loyalty to God, he became known as the last good king of Judah. Unfortunately, Hosea was killed in 609, and Judah ended up becoming a vassal of the new regional power, the Babylonian Empire. Of course, no one likes turning over their lunch money all the time, and Judah tried to revolt. It did not work. And in 597, Babylon reminded them who was boss. Ezekiel was among that large group of Judeans taken into captivity by Babylon. And you can read about that in 2 Kings chapter 24, verses 14 through 16. Ezekiel appears to have spent the rest of his life in Tel Abib, Abib with a B, Abib. Tel means mound. Abib, we're not sure, but we think it means either a spring or a deluge. Tel Abib, remember, with a B, with a B, was in the vicinity of Nippur, near the Chebar Canal, which was part of an intricate system of canals carrying water from the Euphrates River throughout the city of Babylon and its surrounding area. It is possible that the area was subject to spring flooding, and maybe it was a ruin, and the exiles were placed there to rebuild the ruins. About 10 years after this first failed rebellion, Judah tried to rebel again, and this time it was a complete disaster. Not only did Judah lose, they lost big. Babylon burned down the city of Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, tore down everything, and put the rest of the leaders in exile. Now remember, the temple was widely understood to be the unique center of God's presence, and its destruction was seen as God's abandonment of Israel. Ezekiel the person was actually named Ezekiel ben Buzi, which means son of Buzi, and Ezekiel's name means God strengthens, or may God strengthen. We know that he was born into a priestly family of Jerusalem around 623 BC. And was likely a priest himself, or at least a priest in training, during that reign of the reforming king Hosea. After he is taken captive, apparently he has a house in Tel Abib, again with B's, in Babylon, not Tel Aviv in Jerusalem, Tel Abib in Babylon, because we are told elders visited him in his house. He was married, but we don't know his wife's name, or if they had children, and we have no idea how he supported himself. Since the book of Ezekiel contains more dates than any other Old Testament prophetic book, its prophecies can be dated with considerable precision. In addition, modern scholarship, using archaeology, the Babylonian annals cuneiform tablets, and astronomy, accurate dating of the eclipses referred to in ancient archives. These help provide precise modern calendar equivalents. 12 of the 13 dates specify times when Ezekiel received a divine message. The other is the date of the arrival of the messenger who reported the fall of Jerusalem in chapter 33, verse 21. Having received his call in July of 593 BC, Ezekiel was active for 22 years, his last dated oracle being in April of 571. That's in chapter 29, verse 17. If the 30th year of chapter 1, verse 1 refers to Ezekiel's age at the time of his call, his prophetic career exceeded a normal priestly term of service by 2 years. In Numbers chapter 4, verse 3, it tells you how long priests are to serve. Ezekiel's period of activity coincides with Jerusalem's darkest hour. The various dates given in the book suggest that Ezekiel was 25 years old when he went into exile. He was 30 years old when he received his prophetic call, and 52 years old at the time of the last vision, around 571-570. And here's a piece of trivia. Even though Ezekiel is taken captive by Babylon, he never mentions Babylon by name. If you've read the book of Ezekiel, then you know that Ezekiel the person was, to say the least, eccentric, if not downright bizarre. For example, in Ezekiel chapter 4, he lays down on his left side, bound up, for 390 days. And then on his right side, also bound up, for 40 days, in front of a mock-up of Jerusalem being attacked, to signify how long Israel, remember the northern kingdom, 390 years, and Judah, the southern kingdom, for 40 years, would be made to suffer for their many sins. And Ezekiel the book is not only a weird book, it is also a gruesome book. Part of this may have been due to the violent background of the times. The first half of the book contains poetic oracles that describe the horrors of those years in unflinching detail. This section concludes with a depiction of the walled city as an iron pot with pieces of dead bodies floating in a gruesome stew. That's in Ezekiel chapter 24. Images of death permeate the book. Even in the oracles promising restoration to the nation, in Ezekiel chapter 39, for example, it describes future Israelites creating hills out of the bodies of the enemies they have slain. Ezekiel the prophet was highly critical of Israel and its leaders, and insisted that God was bringing about its downfall because the people had for centuries failed to fulfill their covenant with God. The covenant they forged at Mount Sinai had demanded that Israel be undivided in its faithfulness to God. But the people were idolatrous, and according to Ezekiel in chapter 8, their idols had even found their way into the temple. While the covenant demanded that the people observe moral and ethical laws, in chapter 20, Ezekiel outlines how these laws were repealed and or overlooked by each generation. In chapter 22, Ezekiel points out that while the covenant demanded that society be just, its leaders were oppressors, perpetrators of violence and bloodshed. In Ezekiel's view, because Israel had rebelled and failed to honor its covenant with God, they were experiencing the consequences of their disobedience, including deportation, destruction, and death. While Ezekiel offered no hope that their homeland would survive Babylonian aggression, Ezekiel also opposed any notion that God was powerless, apathetic, or unjust. Ezekiel insisted that God was both in control of the events and justified in the way that those events were controlled. God's punishments were a just response to Israel's long-lived sin. Ezekiel has nothing positive to say to those who remained in Jerusalem following the deportations of 597 and 586. To Ezekiel's mind, God's punishment and destruction of Jerusalem was fully justified, and few would survive. Ezekiel was also harsh of his fellow exiles, but he believed that Israel's future depended on God's dealing with the exiles living in Babylon. Now, seeing how Ezekiel was part of that exile group, I'm not sure we can say Ezekiel was overly objective concerning his assessment of the Judeans who still lived in Jerusalem. But Ezekiel's oracles of doom are not his only words. And much of chapters 33 through 48 contain oracles of restoration, where Ezekiel insists that Israel will not remain in exile forever, because the people's plight dishonors God. For the sake of God's own name, God will regather the people from the nations, return them to their homeland, and ensure that the sins of the past are not repeated. In chapter 36, Ezekiel promises their land will be transformed into a Garden of Eden, prompting astonishment from all who pass by. In chapters 38 and 39, all potential foes will be eliminated in God's final battle against Gog and his army. Gog likely represents the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, and Magog is likely tied to Babylon. But over the centuries, some have tried to identify these names with contemporary places, people, or events. Some of you may remember such comparison back in the 1980s between Gog and Magog and the Soviet Union. But such comparisons are simply imaginative and fanciful thoughts. Gog and Magog are also mentioned in the book of Revelation, where they come to symbolize any force that opposes God. In the end, God's glory will return to a new and perfectly ordered temple, as we see in Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48. In chapter 37, Ezekiel, by the way, has 48 chapters. And on the surface, it appears that they fall neatly into three parts. God's judgment of Israel in chapters 1 through 24. God's judgment of the nation in chapters 25 through 32. That's God's judgment of the nations, chapter 25 through 32. And God's restoration of Israel is in chapters 33 through 48. But within that threefold structure, it resists any easy organization. Our passage in Ezekiel 37 falls into this last category, God's restoration of Israel. This is the third and most well-known of the four visions that are shared in the book. Ezekiel's vision of dry bones brought to life with the breath of God, an image of the restoration of the nation. And by the way, this is not intended as a literal description of the resurrection from the dead. In verse 1, some translations say Ezekiel was placed in the middle of a valley. Others say he was placed in a plain. The word can be translated correctly either way, and some of your Bibles may have that as a footnote. But for Ezekiel's original audience, the description of a field strewn with dry bones would have probably called to their mind images of battlefields. When an army was defeated, the victor would often leave most of the corpses unburied, stripping the bodies of any valuables, while leaving the flesh for carrion birds and other predators. An additional gruesome detail that is not in the verse, but would certainly have been in the minds of the exiles, is the Assyrian victory artwork of vultures flying above battlefields with severed heads in their claws, others with dripping entrails. In fact, if you skip ahead, Ezekiel chapter 39, verses 17 through 20, depicts God summoning carrion birds to a sacrificial feast of dead bodies. Like I said, it's gruesome. In verse 2, we are told there are a lot of bones, and that the bones are very dry. Again, the vision is likely intended to depict the many bones as belonging to the entire nation of Israel. And the fact that the bones are very dry is that the bones have been picked clean a long, long time. Such a detail reminds us that this is a vision of the future, a far, far future. An interesting aside is that the lectionary usually pairs this Old Testament reading of Ezekiel and the Valley of Dry Bones with the Gospel reading from the Gospel of John, chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus. In that Gospel reading, you may recall, Lazarus has been in a tomb for 4 days when Jesus shows up. In our reading, the Valley of Dry Bones, it's a much longer period of time than 4 days. The Valley of Dry Bones is not mostly dead, to quote from Princess Bride. This valley is dead, dead. In verse 3, when Ezekiel is asked, "Can these bones live?" Ezekiel's answer, "O Lord, you know," is not an evasion. It's not an evasion. It's an acknowledgement that God is the source of life. In verses 4 through 8, we see details in the vision, the noise of the bones coming together, the anatomical detail of bones, sinews, and flesh, which gives the passage the feel of gritty corporeality. If this were a Hollywood movie, the critics would say that the special effects were incredibly realistic. In verses 5 through 6, 8 through 10, and verse 14, the word ruah, the Hebrew word ruah, can mean breath, spirit, or wind. All are acceptable. And sometimes it is interesting to substitute the various words as you read the passage. The wind would likely refer to the four points of the compass, north, south, east, and west. And the word breath would bring to mind the creation story in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. Then God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. In fact, that story creates a proper background for understanding this story. It is God's spirit, there's that word again, that brings life, hope, and restoration. In verse 11, we hear again the echo of the people's despair. To those who are saying, "Our bones are dried up, our hope is lost, and we are cut off completely." That middle phrase, "our hope is lost," can also be translated as, "our hope is gone," or "our hope has perished." It's not just bones and bodies that need to be resuscitated. So does hope. Verses 12 through 14 focuses on the kind of power God wields. But notice, God does not say, "You will know that I am your God because I loved you so much." But rather, "Once you see I can bring people back from the dead, you will know that I am truly God." This focus on divine power is a theme that can be traced throughout the book. In Ezekiel, God's actions are linked to God's reputation. Clearly, those who experienced the exile were questioning the power of God. Ezekiel chapter 37 provides one more way that the book counters such doubt. It does not matter how long the nation is dead, God can still restore it. The vision offers good news to the exiles, who have been oppressed by military powers and by overwhelming political forces that control their existence. It offers good news to the oppressed exiles who have been beaten down by their own sins and are suffering under the weight of those sins of their ancestors. But it's not just a historic vision. It's a prophetic vision given to us all, reminding us that God can and will give life, not only to those oppressed by military violence and political powers, but to those who are burdened by their sin. Such a vision brings not only release from bondage, but also hope to those who feel caught in a hopeless situation. See, the purpose of the passage isn't just about restoring Israel, although certainly that's what the people are thinking. Exile would be finished, they would be able to return home, their country would be reestablished. But the intention is in verse 13. You shall know that I am the Lord. God's total sovereignty is also evident in God's mobility. God is not limited to the temple in Jerusalem. God can respond to the people's sin by leaving the sanctuary in Israel, and God can graciously visit God's exiled children, even in Babylon. God is free to judge, and God is equally free to be gracious. God's stern judgments on Israel ultimately reflect God's grace. God allows the total dismemberment of Israel's political and religious life so that her renewed life and God's presence with her will be clearly seen as a gift from the Lord of the universe. Thank you so much for listening. I hope this has been helpful. Take care and God bless.